Support for this podcast comes from the Peabody Essex Museum, presenting Ethiopia at the Crossroads. On view now. Find out more about the exhibition at PEM.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When Camille Paglia first exploded onto the American public scene 15 years ago with her first book, Sexual Personae, she arrived in what is now her trademark style, searingly smart, pugnacious, challenging, exhilarating. Paglia is a standout American intellectual, an author, cultural critic, and social observer whose brimming mind never shies away from apparent contradiction or controversy. She argued passionately for feminism and against mainstream feminists, for popular culture and against elitism. Now Camille Paglia has the legacy of Western art and poetry in particular in her sights. Art, she says, is the very foundation of Western society and culture. In a world ruled by memory-free materialism and grinding geopolitics, she says, art is the force that steadies us, that keeps us rooted and nourished. Poetry can light the spirit and feed the soul. America's academic world is failing, she says, to keep that connection alive. Now, Camille Paglia is taking it to the streets. Poetry, she says, belongs to us all. And in her latest book, she picks 43 poems to get us started. Tonight on Point, rescuing Western culture through its poetry with the great and provocative cultural critic, Camille Paglia. You can join the conversation. Is art, is poetry at the heart and soul of Western society? Are Shakespeare, Wordsworth, Sylvia Plath, and Joni Mitchell nurturers and pillars in your own life? Are you up for the ride? Ready to hear? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me in the studio tonight is Camille Paglia, professor of humanities and media studies at the University of the Arts in Philadelphia. Her previous books, Sexual Personae, Sex, Art, and American Culture, and Vamps and Tramps, were all published to enormous critical acclaim. Her new book is Break, Blow, Burn. Camille Paglia reads 43 of the world's best poems. Camille Paglia, it's wonderful to have you with us.
Great to be here, Tom. Thank you for inviting me.
It's just fantastic. And I cannot tell you how much I enjoyed this book, your essays, just one after another out behind these tremendous poems. 43, I mean, it's an anthology, but it's really an anthology shot all through with Camille Paglia as kind of oracle and interpreter of poems, of culture, of everything that came before. I don't have any doubt there's restorative work to be done here, and it looks like you've made a very marvelous start in doing that. But after all your really provocative titles to come out, I mean, you chose a great line here from John Donne, Break, Blow, Burn, but still, it is kind of an anthology of poetry, which is almost feels like it rubs up against Camille Paglia, you know, She Who Burns Continents.
Well, it took 5 years to do this book, and I've been off the scene, just devoting myself to it. What I'm trying to do is re-engage the general audience, and particularly the young people, with art, and also to ignite a passionate enthusiasm for art as an antidote to this depressing three decades of post-structuralism and postmodernism, with its all that hip, cynical irony and that stupid posture of fake cool, which I think is a blight on American creativity. We're never going to get any revival of the American arts until we get rid of all of that, that attitude of deconstruction of what I regard as vandalism of literature, and try to get young people to feel as if all of art belongs to them, and as if the cosmos is waiting for them to make a mark with their voice.
We're going to hear that tonight in these wonderful poems, and they're really great. And I just loved your interpretive essays. But for people who don't live inside those academic walls, who don't even know what deconstruction is, you're talking about that hip, stupid irony. But in your view, what came before, or what was better? What happened, and why? And what are you trying to do now? What's the alternate? What's the Paglia way of looking at these poems?
Well, when I was in college in the 1960s, it was the declining phase of what was called New Criticism, which would study the internal qualities of a poem. Now, that style had been created in the 20s and 30s by very brilliant poets and critics beginning in England. But by the 1950s and 60s, it was in a decadent phase. I was I felt I was in total revolt against it. I felt it was too genteel, too Protestant, that it didn't allow for the aggressions in artistic creativity, that it didn't allow for sex and all kinds of dangerous things which I felt were there in art. But as the decades went on, I began to realize that the foundation of my education had been this very close scrutiny of text, and that when these French theorists came into American academia in the 70s, they destroyed, that style destroyed the New Criticism. I think it's time now, 30 years on, to bring the New Criticism back, but to supplement it with what was missing from it, which would mean some history, some biography, some sense of social context, politics, and so on. So this is what I've tried to do in Break, Blow, Burn. I've tried to write artistic analyses of these poems, but at the same time grounded in the social context from which they arose.
Artistic analyses, mm-hmm. but they're really kind of compass settings for living.
Yes, I think the sense of beauty. When I came on the scene in 1990 with Sexual Personae, I talked beauty, 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 mm-hmm. pleasure, pleasure, pleasure. And it really, even my enemies were eventually affected by it, because the subject of beauty is back on the table throughout the 90s now in terms of the art. So I'm sick and tired of people talking down to art, looking at the artwork and finding everything that's wrong with it. You know, it's racism, sexism, homophobia, or the artwork means nothing, that meaning cancels itself out, or the author is dead, or whatever it is. These are tired old theories that have to be swept clean. They don't belong to our tradition. We're the tradition of rock and roll, rhythm and blues. We don't need this crap. You know, when this stuff came over from Paris in the 70s, it was already passé in Paris. The whole thing's a joke. It's a joke. But you could make a killing. You could make a killing, okay, as a professor in America. That's the big secret, okay? By mouthing fake leftism. It's not even real leftism, okay? These professors have made millions of dollars, right, and are living lifestyles of gross materialism. And they've destroyed the humanities and destroyed pleasure and art.
Kind of sawing them off at the root.
Several generations of students, right, their appreciation of art has been ruined, and all kinds of talented young people left the graduate schools in droves over the last 25 years. They come to my readings, they tell me about it, okay? So all that's left are the drones. The drones are left. Tenured mediocrities.
Tenured mediocrities, and the consequences, you say, go right out of academia, right in. I mean, you're talking about even popular culture, of which you mm-hmm. have been an enormous fan, being kind of bled in recent years.
Yes.
I want to begin to get into this. You say, my secular but semi-mystical view of art is that it taps primal energies, breaks down barriers, and imperiously remakes our settled way of seeing. That takes me right to the title of your book. I mean, this break, blow, burn mm-hmm. sounds like breaking down barriers. Remind us of the John Donne poem that this came from, and the very kind of visceral, spiritual, philosophical, and quite physical imagery he's using there.
Well, I have religious poems in the book, even though I'm an atheist myself. But I respect religion. I think I regard religion as a complex symbol system that is far more interesting and deep and profound than anything that the academy is currently teaching. But this sonnet by John Donne, here you have a very powerful personality who is demanding that God break through the hardened door of his heart.
Batter my heart, three-person mm-hmm. God.
And in effect, this very heterosexual poet is asking to be raped by God's force. The image is actually that of a pot. God is a potter who is looking at the soul, the tattered soul of Donne, and saying, I don't think this can be repaired anymore. I'm going to need to hammer it down into pieces, melt it, and remake a new soul.
And John Donne saying, go ahead, do
it. Yes, go ahead.
Bust me up.
Otherwise, I'm on the way to hell. If you don't rape me, then I will be abducted by Satan.
Knock, breathe, shine, seek to mend that I may rise and stand, or throw me and bend your force to break, blow, burn, and make me new.
Mm-hmm. So for and I'm very influenced here by the Art for Art's Sake movement, typified by Oscar Wilde in the late 19th century, I feel that art has a spiritual dimension. Art is my religion. There's no doubt about it. And I feel that every great poem, every great work of art is sacred in some sense. And the critic should revere art. And the critic should serve art and open a way between the audience and the artwork. Not get in the way. Not trash the artwork. Okay, these people are criminals. They're criminals, what they've done to art. And so I feel that in this period where the young are surrounded by now a very low-level popular culture in which the web is now the dominant form of communication, which I champion. I began writing for Salon.com from its first issue in 1995. Mm-hmm. Okay, I champion it. But a young generation totally immersed in this decrepit popular culture and the web with all its like speed in its truncated kind of language, this is just a soullessness that's happening. With art, whether it's a great poem or a great painting, you stop, you stare, you focus, okay? You're alone with the artwork, right? And we must encourage young people and general readers, right, to begin that engagement, again, or to renew it if they had it in college.
Are we still capable? Given that
yes.
we're pickled in all this mass media and the
yes.
web and everything,
yes.
we can still go back. The ordinary American citizen, look at Shakespeare, look at John Donne, look at Whitman, you name it.
There was a time when American poetry was at the heart of American culture. Throughout the 19th century, the period of Whitman, right down to World War II. Actually, people enjoyed poetry declamations. They would memorize and recite poems in high school and so on. That habit is gone because of the dominance of modern popular culture. Our songs, the music, movies, everything has supplanted that. So I think it's time again to look at the poem again. I believe that there is a kind of contemplative quality to our solitude with the individual work of art.
But you were all for pop culture when it still had this kind of mythos of the traditional culture behind it, in it.
Hollywood is America's greatest contribution to world culture. The fine arts have never taken deep root in America. We are a very practical, business-oriented country.
But you're saying it's being drained, being cut off from
Hollywood at its height had a passionate intensity, a range, a vision. Okay, there was an emotional resonance to the great acting. Okay, and a lavishness to the presentation. Now we're in a period of special effects, snarkiness, cynicism. I fear for young people brought up on the current pop.
We are exiting the snarky zone tonight with Camille Paglia. Her new book is Break, Blow, Burn. Camille Paglia reads 43 of the world's best poems. You can join us tonight. Have 3 decades of skeptical, deconstructionist reading cut us off from our own cultural heritage? And is Western culture in trouble because we no longer treasure it? We no longer know and feel its lifeblood. You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back with poetry. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about rescuing and loving Western culture through its poetry with the great and provocative cultural critic Camille Paglia. Her new book is Break, Blow, Burn. Camille Paglia reads 43 of the world's best poems. You can join us tonight. Are you ready to seriously read Shakespeare and Blake and Dickinson as explosive and vital as an antidote to the narrow confines of contemporary thought? Are you ready to take Camille Paglia as your wise guide, your seer, your oracle? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, there's a great sweep of history in here, all the way back to John Donne and Shakespeare and Wordsworth and Blake and right on through Wallace Stevens, William Carlisle Williams, and right on up. By the time we get to the 50s, 60s, you've got a great big helping of Sylvia Plath in here with this just hinder-kicking poem, Daddy. We've got recorded portions of this with Sylvia Plath herself reading it. This is not the complete poem. For some reason, it's come in portions, but we'll hear that as it is. Here's Sylvia Plath reading Daddy.
You do not do any more black shoe in which I have lived like a foot for 30 years, poor and white, barely daring to breathe or ha-choo. Daddy, I have had to kill you. You died before I had time. Marble heavy, a bag full of God, ghastly statue with one gray toe big as a Frisco seal. Not God, but a swastika, so black no sky could squeak through. Every woman adores a fascist, the brute in the face, the brute heart of a brute like you. You stand at the blackboard, Daddy, in the picture I have of you, a cleft in your chin instead of your foot. But no less a devil for that, no, not any less the black man who bit my pretty red heart in two. I was 10 when they buried you. At 20, I tried to die, and get back, back, back to you. I thought even the bones would do. But they pulled me out of the sack, and they stuck me together with glue. So, Daddy, I'm finally through. The black telephone's off at the root. The voices just can't worm through. There's a stake in your fat black heart, and the villagers never liked you. They are dancing and stamping on you. They always knew it was you. Daddy, Daddy, you bastard, I'm through.
Oh, and we believe it. Sylvia Plath, reading from Daddy. Of course, Sylvia Plath, who famously committed suicide.
Only a little bit, a few months after that reading.
After that reading. Mm-hmm. And there's so much you have to explain to us here. I guess the first thing we need to know is she was daughter of a German immigrant professor and high school teacher. Mm-hmm. But take us away from there. He's not a god, but a swastika. Every woman adores a fascist. What do you hear?
Well, this poem is one of the strongest pieces of writing ever in the history of women's art. It is the ultimate expression of rebellion against the patriarchy, of the control of women by husbands and fathers. But Plath committed suicide in London just before the women's movement awoke again throughout that long period since women had won the right to vote. So this poem became a kind of manifesto of the women's movement. It's had a tremendous effect on women's writing, but not always for the better. The odd thing is that Plath created this style of feminist protest, but she seems to have, I say in the book, exhausted that style by writing this poem. Because
so on fire, garish, sarcastic, profane. The poem itself, you write, seems to be having a nervous breakdown.
Right, it's like a nursery rhyme gone mad. And actually, it's very funny. Properly read, it's extremely funny. And I think even in the Plath's reading, you can hear that she's reading it very archly, and that she finds it humorous. It's not really tragic. I feel that Plath can be seen as the first female rocker. That as she looks forward to,
as in rock and roll,
That you can see expressions like this. Let's say late 70s, early 80s, Pat Benatar. You know, hit me with your best shot, or Love is a Battlefield, or I say in the book, Chrissy Hynde in The Pretenders, or Marianne Faithfull's great album Broken English, with all its profanity and its limits testing and so on.
And only women, Yardbirds, The Who, Jimi Hendrix, when they smash up their guitars, they're in the Sylvia Plath mode.
Yes, I say, yes. So, when you break the guitar or set the guitar on fire, it's exactly what Plath did by putting her head in an oven and killing herself. She is the instrument of her poetry. But every time women trying to imitate this poem have failed, and their poems become monotonous litanies of complaints against men. It's a whining, whining, whining. What they don't realize is that Plath had studied all of the major male figures in the history of poetry. She so revered William Butler Yeats that she chose the apartment where she committed suicide because Yeats had lived in that house, and there was a plaque saying that on the house. She learned from Robert Lowell. She learned from Theodore Refke. So this is the problem with feminist writing since Plath. They think that only by immersing ourselves in women's voices can you do something strong. No, everything's gotten weaker and weaker since Daddy.
And that's about the poets. But what about, you're asking the whole country to plug in here again, asking, let's say, women in this case to plug into Daddy. It's as you say, garish, profane. What is a woman reader to take from this?
Well, it's the images. I mean, it's phenomenal. Plath had studied and studied and studied writing since she was very young. And so here's her nervous breakdown just before she commits suicide, and everything comes flowing out of her. These images, the images of Massachusetts, the images that are drawn from her childhood near Boston. I mean, they it's like this surreal epic that we see passing in front of us. I mean, the images are phenomenal. Even the structure of the poem is phenomenal. You expect a kind of four-line stanza, and it's five lines. So you feel, and each one is connected to the next. So you're on this roller coaster. You can't stop. You're inside Sylvia Plath's, at that point, psychotic brain.
And what about women's relationship with men? She writes, "So, Daddy, I'm finally through. Mm-hmm. The black telephone's off at the root. Mm-hmm. The voices just can't worm through. I mean, this is, she's unplugging from the messages of men entirely. Mm-hmm. She's pulling it out of the wall.
Yes, and this was, this suicide thing, which belongs to the age of the avant-garde, as an Italian, I think that that's passé, these gestures of suicide to prove the authenticity of your vision. I think that, get over that, I want to say, so on. Live, go eat, go have something to eat, go have something to drink. And that's what I would say. At the end, we expect her to say, I'm free, not I'm through. Okay. So then I say she sort of throws herself off into the white space at the end of the poem, exactly the way Sappho, falsely in a legend, was said to have thrown herself off a cliff into the sea and committed suicide. So it's an extraordinary poem because it's so funny, because it's so sarcastic and satirical, when we know she paid the price with her own life for having gone so far with it.
And a kind of empowerment, but empowerment that left her dead.
Yes, right. And the thing is that Plath was very studious, and I think that that's what's missing from so much 10th-rate feminist writing since then. Okay, just the endless mawkishness and the male bashing. Okay?
Don't mince words.
All right. Right, because Plath also studied Emily Dickinson, okay, another great Massachusetts poet who was also in the book. She's represented by three poems in the book, and Dickinson's ability to create images, to work in miniature, and yet to get an epic sweep in the tiniest syllable or word. That's another thing that Plath learned, okay, from a predecessor.
We'll get to Emily Dickinson, but you mentioned Robert Lowell, and we've got a reading from Robert Lowell here, a piece of Man and Wife. Let's listen. Robert Lowell.
Tamed by Milltown, we lie on mother's bed. The rising sun in war paint dyes us red. In broad daylight, her gilded bedposts shine, abandoned, almost Dionysian. At last, the trees are green on Marlborough Street. Blossoms on our magnolia ignite the morning with their murderous 5 days white. All night I've held your hand as if you had a fourth time faced the kingdom of the mad, its hackneyed speech, its homicidal eye, and dragged me home alive. Oh, my petite, clearest of all God's creatures, still all air and nerve, you were in your 20s, and I, once hand on glass and heart in mouth, outdrank the robs in the heat of Greenwich Village, fainting at your feet. Too boiled and shy and poker-faced to make a pass, while the shrill verve of your invective scorched the traditional South. Now, 12 years later, you turn your back. Sleepless, you hold your pillow to your hollows like a child. Your old-fashioned tirade, loving, rapid, merciless, breaks like the Atlantic Ocean on my head.
Robert Lowell, reading his own Man and Wife, all kinds of images we want to understand there. You describe this as a classic love poem that demonstrates the survival of tenderness through bitterness and alienation. We'll have listeners right from Atlantic to Pacific tonight that won't all catch some of the local references there. And the South comes in here as well. Unfold this one for us.
Okay, Kat. Well, Robert Lowell, of course, his family went all the way back to the 17th century. He was descended from a long line of great preachers and so on. And he was the decadence, of that line. He had many nervous breakdowns, and he had to be really nursed back to health. And this, the woman in this poem is Elizabeth Hardwick, a distinguished writer in her own right, who had to act many times as a kind of nursemaid for him. She was from the South, so what you're getting is a culture clash in the poem between old New England with its noble intellectual heritage, and then the South. Elizabeth Hardwick, in some way, was a kind of Southern, Iron Magnolia, all right? Mm-hmm. But obviously in her own liberalism, she defied the traditional South. She scorched it, okay? Mm-hmm. And this book from which the poem comes, Life Studies, 1959, is a moment in which Robert Lowell's style becomes easier, more relaxed, more colloquial from the impact of beat poetry coming out of San Francisco and New York at that very moment.
It takes us right into Greenwich Village here, and another kind of shifting of cultural gears. It says, heart and mouth outdrank the robs in the heat of Greenwich Village. Mm-hmm. What's happening there?
Okay, well, Philip Roth was one of the New York Jewish intellectuals. What he represents and what Greenwich Village represents is the new, perhaps the crass in terms of the attitudes of Lowell's distinguished background. So what you're getting
but up and coming and hungry and making things happen.
Yes, the culture is changing, and Lowell feels like almost a kind of a derelict, from a former age. So it's fantastic. Not only do we have this intensity of a love relationship where the role of man and wife has been reversed, where the wife is sustaining the husband, okay, but we also have all of the regions of the United States represented here, all the cultural changes going on, New England, the South, the Jewish culture, intellectual culture, the Bohemian culture. It's this is a phenomenal major poem that any general reader can appreciate, and it's just fantastic to hear Lowell himself reading it.
And the interior cultures of two people, a man and wife, from the title, those never ultimately resolvable, but what you describe here is a kind of maturity that comes where there's this tenderness that crosses, even though she's different, he's different one from another, but they'll live together.
Yes, but it's really kind of the end. Eventually, they would separate. Although he never got over her, he would remarry. And in fact, he died. Trying to get back to her. He had a heart attack in the taxi. They were so intertwined. But this style is the style called confessional poetry that Sylvia Plath belongs to, and Anne Sexton as well, where details from your personal life become part of the fabric of the poem. It's ethically questionable, perhaps. I mean, we can talk about it. Mm-hmm. Some people hold against Robert Lowell the degree to which he would pillage the intimacy of his personal relationship.
Use it, expose it, lay it all out.
Yes, yes. And the same thing with Plath. I mean, what Plath's accusations against her husband, Ted Hughes, made him defend his reputation for the rest of his life.
Yeah,
over in England, there's the Hughes camp and there's the Plath camp, and they practically come to blows.
So there's the personal and the confessional, but you're always ready in these poems to let us sweep up to a very high kind of view of what's going on here. You describe in this Lowell poem ultimately a victory of humor and lucidity over madness, which made me sort of scribble right here in the book, forget these two. Think about the whole country. This victory of humor and lucidity over madness seems to be the missing victory sometimes lately. We still a country that can accomplish that?
Well, I think we need to re-nurture ourselves in art. I think we need to if American civilization means anything, okay, we have to recover the arts. And I'm afraid both sides of the political spectrum have trashed art. That's why I'm on a crusade with this book. Those on the left have badmouthed Western Civ instead of just all ideology and dead white European males, and meanwhile people on the far right have a very moralistic view of art and don't want any kind of art that in fact is limits testing or has any sexual ambiguities in it or and so on, or has
any kind that Camille Paglia would hold up in a nanosecond.
Right, yeah. So I'm asking for both sides of the political divide to rethink the degree to which we have diminished the role that art should play with the general audience.
Camille Paglia, we have a lot of callers who want to join us tonight. Let's turn to them. Joe's calling from La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Joe, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you, and it's such a pleasure to be on the air with you. I have to tell you, with your guest this evening, I'm a huge fan, and that said, I even more admiration for what you've done here, because I couldn't agree more that this is an area that we need to go to. Hmm. We have I taught history and English in high school for a number of years now, and we have a generation of students, and in fact several generations that we've been building on, that are unaware of the building blocks of Western civilization and the connection to art and drama and music and literature. Mm-hmm. And the simple truth is that they're not confronted with these things anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They're not confronted with people who have looked at and made hard decisions, and whether it was Plath and suicide, or whether it was Whitman, or whether it was and pretty much anybody across the spectrum anymore. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter whether it's Rossetti or Elizabeth Barrett Browning. I mean, these are absent from the lives of the average student that you talk to.
Joe, do you think the connective tissue can be rebuilt here?
Oh, I absolutely do, because I think there is right now a vacuum. Mm. And I think it's being filled by things that are synthetic, that people don't even realize are acting as fillers, that they think are real, and that they eventually come to disdain because it's not solid. Mm. It's not something that's real. It's not something that's ultimately transparent as the works that she's describing are. Because if there's anything that connects these works, it's their transparency. Mm. In the sense that These are the artists revealed.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Joe, I think you've nailed it. Wow. And I appreciate you
doing
it.
What a great call. Thank you so much. That was amazing. That was so eloquent. Yes, you know, it goes back to 700 B.C., the tradition of Western arts. And kids today, even coming from the best schools, seem to lack a sense of history, chronology, value, quality.
Well, there, you've got it in a nutshell. But are you confident it can be rebuilt?
Yes. This is a manifesto. I'm directing it toward young people, but also grad students. Please don't drop out of the grad schools. Keep going till you're credentialed and then transform the university. This is for the adjuncts. I taught as an adjunct, and, you know, I struggled along in the early 80s. So it's for the adjuncts who are doing honest, practical criticism, as I say in the intro. I kind of take back the universities. All right? It's for the writers. Let's not put up with this anymore. Okay? Let's put art back at the center, especially for the young.
I think we hear it. Let's go out into the break with William Carlos Williams here reading his own The Red Wheelbarrow.
The Red Wheelbarrow. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens.
That's just a piece of it. It's that short, and it's in your list of the top 43 ever.
Yes,
because
absolutely.
So.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's just a homely farmyard scene. A pastor, someone just walking by, and is suddenly transfixed by the beauty of rainwater glittering on an ordinary object,
glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens.
It's magical. The poetry teaches you how to see. It teaches you to find significance in the insignificant.
We're talking tonight with Camille Paglia. Her new book is Break, Blow, Burn. Take it from John Donne. You can join us. Can we have great popular culture without a great taproot into the roots of culture? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about rescuing and loving Western culture through its poetry with the great and provocative cultural critic Camille Paglia. Her new book is Break, Blow, Burn. Camille Paglia reads 43 of the world's best poems. You can join us tonight. Are you with Camille Paglia in hearing Sylvia Plath as the first female rocker? In hearing rocker Joni Mitchell, and we will, as an important modern poet, are you ready to be broken, blown over, burned by poetry? We're at 1-800-423-8255. She takes us way back, starts right off with Shakespeare at the beginning of this book. Let's hear Shakespeare's sonnet number 73. It's read here by Sir John Gielgud.
That time of year thou mayst in me behold, when yellow leaves, or none, or few, do hang upon those boughs which shake against the cold, bare ruined choirs, where late the sweet birds sang. In me thou seest the twilight of such day as after sunset fadeth in the west, which by and by black night doth take away, death's second self that seals up all in rest. In me thou seest the glowing of such fire that on the ashes of his youth doth lie, as the deathbed whereon it must expire, consumed with that which it was nourished by. This thou perceivest, which makes thy love more strong, to love that well which thou must leave ere long.
Shakespeare's Sonnet 73. I jumped right into the book, Camille, and right away it slows you down. It says, "Wait a minute, this is it. It doesn't last forever." It's such a simple message, so beautifully put. Lots of complexities here as well. But, I mean, it comes down to that.
This is one of the great themes of poetry is mortality and the transience of time. These are great universals. You know, post-structuralism denies there are any universals. Excuse me. There are a couple big ones. And this
Life, death, for example.
Yes, like death. Okay. And nature. You see, post-structuralism doesn't see nature. Now, here we have 14 lines, a simple sonnet, okay, by Shakespeare, and everything is in there. Anyone can identify with it. It's a truly universal poem, no matter what period you were born in, what race you belong to, what culture. And you have three sets of four lines each, where Shakespeare compares man's body to a tree, going through the various phases of the seasons of the year, and it's now autumn of his life. He compares our life to the sun as it sets. This is just a glow on the horizon, and then a fire, the various phases of fire. And he's so intelligent how he sees that a fire has a kind of a life cycle, and he belongs to the point. He's having a kind of a spate of middle-aged angst, okay, and he belongs to the point where there are just embers glowing. And then finally, you have a concluding couplet where he says, "It doesn't matter, that we are subjected to time and death, because there's always love, and love, okay, makes all of life worth living." This is a huge theme in Shakespeare's sonnets, as in his plays.
Reminds us to love that well which thou must leave ere long. Mm-hmm. Botham's calling from Brooklyn. Hi, Brooklyn. Botham, you're on the air.
Hi. I just have, a criticism as to your thoughts on tree dying in our modern-day culture.
Let's hear it.
I believe that the point you're taking is that poetry is such an intellectual, academic thing at this point that you don't see that poetry takes place every day. Not necessarily in books, but in music such as hip-hop or a conversation on the street or speech. I mean, a conversation such as this is a spectrum of life experience through speech. That's poetry itself.
By the way, I think you've got someone who's going to agree furiously with you.
Yes,
I agree.
Yes. Now, by the way, number one, okay, I'm not saying it's academic now, because poetry has been pushed to the margins, actually, in college. It's really the novel or narrative that is the subject of post-structuralism and theory. But yes, hip-hop is booming. There's been 30 years of it. It is a tremendously fertile form. And actually, what you're saying about speech, exactly what I say in the introduction. I listen to talk radio all the time. And I've been listening to AM radio since I was a small child. I say that that the dynamic of the vitality of American speech can be heard in the media. Okay, and that a lot of contemporary poetry seems dead to me, including poetry by the most famous and honored of our poets, because it is too removed, okay, from exactly what you're saying. So I have actually a sense of the colloquial, the vernacular. All of my contemporary poems, my choices are almost entirely by obscure poets who I feel are listening to speech on the street. In fact, I say that to students. I say that to everybody. I say listen to conversations on the street. I listen to them in the stores, on the buses. I'm always overhearing things and actually writing them down. So I totally agree with you.
Perversely, contemporary poetry itself is the removed thing, the formal poetry. Mm-hmm. Let's get another call. Doris is calling from New York City. Hi, Doris. You're on the air.
Oh, hello. Thanks for taking my call. First, I just want to thank Camille Paglia for opening up this conversation. I'm just
Amen.
Delighted. I grew up loving the dead white men and women, and in high school we had to keep a book of favorite poetry, which I'm afraid I lost. We wrote our own Amy Lowell, whoever I loved. And now that I'm older, I joined a senior center, and a lot of the people there are older than me. They're 84, 85. There's a Shakespeare class taught by a very lovely young man. And he keeps bringing in so much text, it took us 4 months to finish reading Merchant of Venice. And the group are people who have grandchildren. I mean, I like singing Bob Dylan now in karaoke bars.
Is the poetry still working for you, Doris?
It sure is. And, I mean, we have had such a delightful time immersing ourselves. We've now moved on to The Tempest. And when he brings in more critical things to read and about, he says, "Do you mind if I read?" And everyone in the class says, "No, no." And, you know, this is a group who were educated this way to read.
It's great. And still being nurtured by it.
Yeah, and I really just, my heart bleeds. I want the young people to have this kind of education, whatever it is, to love words this way.
Doris, right. You've got it. Our time is short. Thanks so much.
That's exactly the point. That is, professors in college should be making choices of what to expose students to that can be of lifetime value. And I think that's what's wrong with what's going, in the last 30 years. Right? This is an investment. So a poem that you learn in college, the feeling of joy with which you re-encounter it, in your 20s, 20s, your 30s, your 40s, your 50s, and you see it in a whole other way, and Shakespeare especially. I mean, Shakespeare seems to change as we ourselves age. It's very, the word I would use is iridescent about great poetry.
Camille Paglia, take us out with another bit of interpretation. At the very end of your book, you include an artist who is not formally considered a poet, but there she is, Joni Mitchell, with Woodstock. You say an important modern poem. What merits her here?
Well,
we're not resisting. We're happy to see it.
I concluded after 5 years of writing the book that Joni Mitchell's Woodstock is, now this is controversial, the most important, the most influential, and the most popular poem written in English since Sylvia Plath's Daddy. Okay, and therefore I sweep away all of the great and current living poets. It's very difficult to transfer a song to the page. Very few lyrics will survive that transition. Now what I did was I arranged Woodstock in the four-line ballad way, and I think that it should be quite clear how beautifully economically shaped it is, and when it's sung in Joni Mitchell's voice,
Not Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young,
you're getting a radical gender drama that's missing from the popular version of Woodstock. So you get what it is the story of Adam and Eve reuniting on the road to paradise, trying to get back to paradise. So when you hear Joni Mitchell singing, also you hear her critique. It's an art song. Her version of it is a lament or dirge. You're hearing the affirmation of the 60s utopian dream of an end to war, racial harmony, and so on. But she's critiquing it. She knows that reality is always going to undermine our dreams.
A harrowing lament for hopes dashed and energies tragically wasted, an elegy for an entire generation. That's Joni Mitchell, just one of 43 in Camille Paglia's new book. We can't get enough of you or your work. I don't want to talk over this too much. Camille Paglia, the new book is Break, Blow, Burn. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Here's Joni Mitchell from her 1970 album, Ladies of the Canyon, singing Woodstock. In a moment, a look at today's meeting between President Bush and Ariel Sharon. This is On Point. President Bush met earlier today with Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon at Bush's ranch in Crawford, Texas. Their meeting came as Sharon prepares for a unilateral pullout of Israeli settlers in the Gaza Strip. And Israel has announced plans to expand settlements in the West Bank. Today, Bush reiterated America's commitment to Israel and praised Sharon for his leadership. Stephen Erlanger is Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times. I asked him to put a headline on today's meeting in Texas.
The headline is George Bush repeats his support for Israel retaining parts of the West Bank in any future deal and urges the Palestinians to cooperate with Israel on the Israeli dismantling of its settlements in Gaza.
Now, just last week, President Bush was saying that he would insist in Crawford that Ariel Sharon, quote, adhere to the roadmap obligations. Is that the way it looks? Has the president pressed Israel on those roadmap obligations?
He has. But the Sharon position and Israel's position has been the roadmap is very nice, but the Palestinians have to do their part of the roadmap basically first. That, of course, we're going to do our part, but the first part the Palestinians have to do is dismantle terrorism, and until they're willing to do that, we don't want to go into final status negotiations with them, and the roadmap isn't really in place. That's going to be harder for Sharon to argue after Gaza. But he buys himself, I think, pretty much till the end of the autumn.
So what were the key statements that you heard coming out of Crawford, Steve, that will resonate there among Israelis and Palestinians?
Well, one of the things the Israelis wanted was Bush to restate in public the commitments he made to Sharon in letters a year ago, which say that in the American point of view, the old 1967 boundaries do not reflect reality, and a final peace settlement should include a recognition that Israel gets to keep some of its big population centers in the West Bank, probably in return for land transfers to the Palestinians elsewhere. Sharon did not get from Bush any clear statement that particular settlements would be okay. And Bush then did the usual contradiction in American policy by saying, but nothing we're saying should prejudge the outcome of final status negotiations. The Palestinians immediately leapt on that and said that Bush was acknowledging colonialism and imperialism by saying that Israel should be able to keep some of its settlements in the West Bank. But, of course, that's something Bush has already said 1 year ago. And the Palestinians did sort of take carefully his promise that he would like to see an independent, contiguous, viable Palestinian state, and that he would hold Sharon to Sharon's promises. The problem is, Sharon has promised in the roadmap to dismantle illegal outposts West Bank created after March 2001. He says he's going to do it, but he hasn't dismantled them. And two, that he would freeze all new settlement activity, including natural growth, which the Israelis haven't done either. And this is something that the United States is simply unwilling to say in public, so it upsets them in private.
Is there any indication that President Bush brought pressure to bear on the most recent announced expansion just there adjacent to East Jerusalem, where the Israelis are talking about adding several thousand new housing units?
Well, he did that effectively by publicly saying that he opposed it. I mean, that's about as much pressure as a president can do. You don't have to do it privately if you do it publicly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was a bit of a trial balloon from the Israelis, because these are housing that won't be built, if they're ever built, for at least two or three more years. Sharon did say that he intends to go ahead and connect this existing settlement, Mala Adumim, which is one of the realities on the ground Bush recognizes, to Jerusalem. And the way to do that is by extending it with new housing. So he said that to his domestic audience. He intends to do that eventually. But Bush has made it clear the United States opposes it, and Israel says it's for down the road. So that's the fight they can have later on.
Stephen Erlanger, does this look like a step closer to successful negotiations with the Palestinians, or a kind of conversation of stalemate?
I don't think it's moved an inch, to be honest, from yesterday. It was basically a restatement of positions. What it was Bush's public support for Sharon, who's been through a difficult political time getting his Gaza plan approved, to say, well done, we support you. And the hint that the United States will help financially the Israelis develop the Negev and the Galilee, which is code word really for letting the Israelis use some money to resettle the Gazan settlers, and instead the United States will help it with other money for the Negev and Galilee. So a kind of quiet transfer of funds. But the basic positions of the two countries haven't changed, and Bush does continue to support Israel's view that the Palestinians, even under Mahmoud Abbas, must do more to keep their promises to stop terrorism and stop violence against Israeli citizens.
And finally, Stephen Erlanger, is the Israeli Prime Minister putting his own personal safety forward as a prod to George Bush to be supportive? He's talked in the United States about having spent his life defending Jews, and now he has to take steps to protect himself from Jews. Israeli officials are talking about what they call Jewish terrorism, that is, threats against Mr. Sharon from extremists who don't want to withdraw anywhere. Is Ariel Sharon telling George Bush, don't push me any further, my life is on the line?
I think he's simply trying to get across to people that it's a risky thing he's doing. I mean, these threats to his life are real. And after all, it was a Jewish fanatic who killed Yitzhak Rabin for doing Oslo. So this has happened before. The security around Sharon is extremely tight. But Israel is not on the edge of civil war, as Sharon claimed today in an interview with the Today Show. It's not even in an atmosphere of civil war. In fact, it is deeply strained justify this Gaza disengagement without question, but civil war is what you get in Rwanda and Cambodia. You're not getting that here.
Stephen Erlanger, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Stephen Erlanger, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times. He spoke with me from Jerusalem. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.